Well, thank you very much, Jane, for those very kind words, and thank you for that very kind and warm welcome. And I do appreciate that you're giving up the lunar eclipse and the Bosox potential victory to be here. I must say I'm a little bit intimidated by speaking in a church. It's not my normal venue, but I'm, you know, I guess it will just go with the flow. I thought maybe I'd begin tonight by saying a word about the title of my new book, because it's a little bit different than the titles of my other books. I mean, in the past with my other books, in a way, I've always tried to come up with something that was maybe a little bit obscure, a little bit deceptive almost, to kind of make the reader think that they were getting something different than they were. I found that could be sort of useful when you write books about left-wing economics. You know, to a certain extent, a certain number of people will buy the book by mistake. They don't know what it's about. You know, they think they're buying a book about cruelty to baby hippos, and before they find out it's a book about the Canadian deficit, they've already bought it. I certainly found that was true when I wrote a book called The Cult of Impotence. I think there were probably a few people that bought that book without realizing that the solutions I was offering were to the problem of democratic impotence. Of course, when you write a book with a title like that, there's all sorts of problems. I mean, you know, a certain number of people don't want to be associated with you, particularly men. Of course, I remember the man I was going out with at the time that I wrote that book, he thought the title was kind of cute, but he wanted me to promise him that under no circumstances would I dedicate the book to him. Anyway, this book is different. I guess partly I felt that, you know, there's been so much deception and misleading information already about the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which is one of the themes in the book, that maybe what we needed instead of more obfuscation and deception was a little bit of clarity. So rather than, you know, sort of to come right out and saying that it wasn't about weapons of mass destruction, it wasn't about Al-Qaeda, it's about that elephant in the room that nobody seems to want to mention and pretends isn't there. In other words, it's about the crude dude. And it strikes me that, you know, probably just about everybody in the world, except George Bush and Dick Cheney, probably will admit now that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and there was no link to Al-Qaeda. And yet, you know, even now that those two big rationales for war have been thoroughly discredited, you know, now the attempt is to blame the whole thing on faulty intelligence. There was a Senate report, U.S. Senate report, that came out and tried to sort of shift the blame onto faulty intelligence. And I remember Wolf Blitzer, you know, from CNN, remember him being on TV and saying, yeah, we all just seem to get caught up in groupthink. He said, you know, we should have all been more skeptical. We should have all been more skeptical? You know, what do you mean, we, white man? I mean, most of us were extremely skeptical. In fact, I think the truth is that once you get beyond that very small group of administration officials and you know, top-level journalists, in fact, there was rampant skepticism in the world about the U.S. case for weapons of mass destruction. I mean, among the chief skeptics was Hans Blix, the U.N. chief weapons inspector, who was actually over there in Iraq before the war and was actively looking for weapons, and he reported very clearly to the U.N. in February 14, 2003, about 3 weeks before, a month before the invasion. He said, we can't find any weapons, and we're getting the full cooperation of the Iraqis now. We'd like to keep looking, but we can't find any. And that was backed up by Mohammed El-Baradei, the chief UN nuclear inspector. So the solution at that point really seemed obvious. Hold the bombs, let the inspections continue, And when the Bush administration revealed later that day that it wouldn't hold back, that it was planning to continue with its invasion anyway, the world kind of collectively choked in disbelief. And do you remember the next day, something like 10 million people took to the streets all over the world to protest this upcoming war? And so it strikes me that, you know, without any access to intelligence data, with nothing more than raw questioning minds, something like 10 million people around the world were able to clearly figure out what the top paid journalists were apparently unwilling or unable to see, and that was that there was no validity to the U.S. case for invasion. And in fact, those demonstrations, around the world, one of the most common signs everywhere was some variation of no blood for oil. In other words, people got the connection. And, you know, you really had to wonder what was the big rush to go to war? I mean, the inspections were clearly working. I remember watching on TV every night as UN inspectors actually supervised the destruction of Al-Samud missiles in Iraq, all very orderly. And yet the inspections had to be called off so that the bombing could begin, so that, you know, a city of 5 million people could be subjected to bombing. I remember Bush went on TV that first night and said he was doing this in order to make the world a more peaceful place, you know, which really makes you wonder what he might do if he was trying to make the world a more violent place. But, you know, right from the beginning, of course, there was this denial about the whole question of oil. And in fact, if you so much as raised the specter of oil being an issue or a factor, you were dismissed as a conspiracy theorist. And even now, a year and a half later, you know, when all the weapons arguments have been thoroughly discredited and the Al-Qaeda connections discredited, you know, now we've moved on to this new argument, that it's about liberating the people of Iraq. And the media is just, you know, happy to take that as the new explanation. You know, now we have endless discussions about things like, can the U.S. bring democracy to the Middle East? Is that part of the world ready for democracy? I mean, the basic assumption in all these questions that just continue and just multiply on top of each other is the assumption that the U.S. actually did the invasion for the purpose of bringing democracy to the Middle East, even though there's no evidence whatsoever to support that. Now, the reason, of course, that there's no admission about the oil factor is that, you know, that it's terribly important what the rationale was to go to war, because that essentially defines what kind of war it is. Now we're hearing, of course, that it's a war of liberation. Well, you know, there's no such animal as a war of liberation in international law. That simply doesn't exist, and it doesn't exist for a reason, because if wars of so-called liberation were allowed, then any country would be free to feel, you know, go next door and liberate whenever they felt that that was in their interest to do so. In fact, it's interesting that every conquering army in history pretty well has defined their mission as being that of liberator. You know, all the way back to Genseric, king of the Vandals in 420 AD, who invaded North Africa, claiming he was coming as a liberator. Now, of course, that wasn't at all what he really did. He pillaged and destroyed and looted, and that's why, of course, the name the Vandals lives on 16 centuries later. And it's interesting to imagine what the word Bush might mean in the vocabulary 16 centuries from now. But the truth is, international law places severe restrictions on when countries are entitled to use armed force. And in fact, it restricts them to only two scenarios. The first scenario is if a country is actually the victim of armed attack. And the second one is if it's in the interest of the collective security of the world, and only in that case is it permissible if it has the approval of the UN Security Council. Now, these laws, I'm referring to the UN and the UN Charter, which, let's not forget, was put in place with the efforts on the part of the entire world after the Second World War. And the purpose of coming together like that and setting up this body of law was to prevent the world from ever experiencing the horror that we experienced in the Second World War. In other words, to prevent wars of aggression. So they defined very clearly the only circumstances under which international force could be used in the international community. Now, Washington, of course, knows all this, and they clearly recognize that, in fact, they had not been the victim of an armed attack from Iraq, so they didn't qualify for the first one. So they tried the second one. They went to the UN Security Council and tried to get approval for the idea of invading and tried to get support for the invasion, but they didn't get it. Despite all their pressure and all their attempts to cajole and pressure and push people on the Security Council to support them, they were unable to get that approval. So they simply withdrew their application for approval and they went in and invaded anyway. In other words, they invaded illegally. And that's exactly what Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the UN, said just last month in an interview on the BBC, that there was an illegal war. In other words, it was a war outside the limits of what's allowed in the UN Charter. It was essentially a war of aggression. And the Nuremberg Tribunal, after the Second World War, that was set up to judge the Nazis, made it clear that starting a war of aggression was, in the minds of the judges at Nuremberg, the supreme international crime. Because out of that initial launching of a war of aggression, all the horrors of war eventually would unfold. It's so ironic when we see Bush and Rumsfeld and the people in his administration, talking about how they are on the high moral ground. I saw Rumsfeld on TV just the other night talking about, how moral the U.S. is compared to the people they're fighting, because the U.S. so scrupulously avoids casualties. I mean, he seemed to be sort of comparing himself to, the likes of Zarqawi, saying, we don't behead people. It seems like an odd standard to compare yourself. You're better than the guys that behead people. But they make a big deal out of this. The U.S. makes a big deal out of saying that they scrupulously try and avoid casualties. Well, in fact, whether or not they do, which is a debatable question, their smart bombs aren't always as smart as they say, it essentially doesn't matter. Because if they're the ones that started a war of aggression, then any casualties are illegal and immoral.